I want to start today by asking you to visualize the absolute backbone of the outdoor industry. And before your mind races to the latest carbon fiber compound bow or those high-tech coolers,
The ones that cost as much as a used car.
exactly, before you go there, stop. I'm talking about something completely invisible. It is, well, it's boring, it's bureaucratic, and yet it is arguably the single biggest gatekeeper determining who gets to hunt, who gets to guide, and, whether the sport survives the next decade.
You were talking about the world's least sexy topic, insurance.
I am talking about insurance, specifically liability insurance. And I know asking a listener to tune in for a deep dive on insurance premiums sounds like a hard sell.
It does.
But looking at the source material we have today, this announcement from the American Hunting Lease Association, or AHLA, this isn't really about paperwork. It's about a fundamental shift in how we value risk.
And how we protect tradition. That's the right framing.
Yeah.
If you peel back the layers of this announcement, what you find is a really interesting case study in, well, market disruption. You have this legacy system commercial insurance that was just slowly strangling a specific group of professionals. And you have an organization stepping in to try and rewrite the rules.
And the stakes are high here. We're not just talking about saving a few bucks. We're talking about whether professional guides and outfitters can actually afford to stay in business.
Exactly. If the math doesn't work for them, the access just disappears for the rest of us.
Precisely. So for today's deep dive, we are unpacking the AHLA's new master program for guides and outfitters. We need to look at what was broken in the old model, how this new policy works, and why this shift might just be a blueprint for other industries too.
Let's do it.
Okay, so let's set the stage with the players involved. The AHLA isn't a new kid on the block, right? They've been in this fight for a while.
Well, they have. They were founded back around 2010. And to understand why this new program matters, you have to remember what the vibe was like in the hunting world back then.
The decline of the hunter narrative.
Yes, the prevailing narrative, and frankly, the data backed it up, was that hunting was in a death spiral.
I remember that vividly. The idea that kids weren't picking it up, the old guard was aging out.
That was part of it. But the bigger issue was access. Access was just drying up. Land was getting sold off, subdivided, developed.
And landowners were scared.
Terrified of lawsuits. They didn't want to let anyone on their property because if someone tripped in a gopher hole and broke an ankle, the landowner could lose the farm.
So the AHLA started as a sort of rescue mission.
Their words, yeah. But that's a good way to put it. They wanted to come to the rescue. Their specific innovation back then was creating a master liability policy for hunt clubs.
So making it cheap and easy for a group of guys to insure a lease.
Exactly. So the landowner felt safe letting them hunt.
And it worked.
It worked incredibly well. I mean, fast forward to today, they've insured over 10,000 hunt clubs. We're talking millions of acres across almost every state.
Wow.
They effectively solved that access problem for the weekend warrior, the
Yeah.
guy leasing the back 40 for deer season.
But, and here is the pivot for today's discussion, they realized they had left a massive gap. They fixed the problem for the hobbyist, but they totally ignored the professionals.
Guides, the outfitters.
The people whose actual mortgage payments depend on taking clients into the field.
And that is a much harder nut to crack. Insuring a couple of buddies sitting in a deer stand is one thing. Insuring a commercial operation where money's changing hands, that introduces a whole new level of liability. The courts look at professionals very differently.
Yeah, the source material highlights the struggle vividly. I think people outside the industry have this romanticized view of a hunter guide,
Oh, absolutely.
You picture a guy just hiking around beautiful mountains all day, spotting scopes, maybe a campfire at night, living the dream.
It's a nice image. But the reality, as the AHLA points out, is grueling. It's a 247 grind.
Just constant.
Constant. You're scouting when you aren't guiding. You're fixing equipment when you aren't scouting. You're managing client expectations.
Which is a whole other job in itself.
A whole other job, constantly. But the AHLA's argument is that the hardest part isn't the work, it's the overhead.
Specifically, the cost of protection.
The cost of liability insurance. It's gone through the roof. It's reached the point where, for many small to mid-sized outfitters, the math just doesn't work anymore.
So you could be the best guide around, but if your insurance premium eats your entire profit margin.
You're out of business. Simple as that.
So let's dig into why it's so expensive. Is hunting just that dangerous? Or is the insurance industry getting it wrong?
This is where we get into what they call the industry blind spot. The AHLA argues that the traditional insurance market It just paints with a massive, clumsy brush.
They see guides and outfitters as one big group?
A single monolithic risk category. So to an actuary sitting in a high-rise somewhere, a guy taking a father and son pheasant hunting in a cornfield is basically the same risk as a massive operation running helicopter bear hunts in Alaska.
That seems wrong.
It is. But the real kicker, and this is the technical detail that drives everyone crazy, is how they calculate the price. The old model relies almost entirely on estimated gross receipts.
Gross receipts, so total revenue.
Total revenue. That's the primary lever for the premium calculation.
Hold on, let me make sure I'm processing this. The more successful I am, the more clients I book, the more revenue I generate, the more dangerous the insurance company thinks I am.
That's the standard model. It's a proxy for exposure. Their logic is more clients equals more opportunities for something to go wrong. If you make $50,000, you pay X. If you make $500,000, you might pay 10X.
That feels incredibly lazy. It completely ignores how you are making that money.
It is lazy.
Yeah.
And it's fundamentally flawed.
Because if I'm making more money, I might be reinvesting that in better equipment, hiring more experienced staff. I might have better safety protocols.
You might have the safest operation in the state.
Right. Success doesn't necessarily correlate with negligence.
Exactly. You could argue the opposite. The guy barely scraping by might be the one cutting corners on safety gear or using old, unreliable vehicles. But the gross receipts model, it penalizes success. It's effectively a success tax.
Run a great business, pay more.
That's the deal. And it's infuriating. That's what triggered the AHLA leadership, specifically their COO, Sean Ferbrage, to intervene. They saw this gap where good, safe guides were being bled dry by premiums that didn't reflect their actual behavior.
They realized these guides deserve a break.
They did. But, you know, you don't get a break in the insurance world by just asking nicely.
No, you need data. You need a lever. You need to prove that the risk isn't what they think it is.
You need to carve out a new risk profile. And this is the fascinating part of the negotiation. Ferbrage went to the carriers, the big underwriters who actually hold the money, and he pitched a new theory.
Okay.
He argued that there's a subsector of guides who are objectively lower risk, and they shouldn't be subsidizing the high-risk cowboys.
So they're unbundling the risk. What does this safe guide look like in their eyes? Because obviously they can't insure everyone at a discount.
Right. So the profile they pitched is the day trip guide. This is the professional who meets the client in the morning, facilitates the hunt, and says goodbye in the evening.
So no overnight lodging.
No lodging. Lodging complicates things immensely from a liability standpoint. You have food poisoning, fire, slips in the shower, alcohol.
All kinds of variables.
A huge chunk of potential variables. So by cutting that out and cutting out the high-altitude multi-day expeditions, you're left with things like white-tailed deer, turkeys, pheasants, predators, fly fishing.
Much more controlled environments, yeah. Known variables. It's a much tighter box.
Precisely. The argument was, why are we charging the pheasant guide in Kansas the same base rate structures as the mountain lion guide in the Rockies? And they convinced the carrier to listen.
But here's the problem I see. Talk is cheap. Anyone can say they run a safe operation. How does the insurance company or the AHLA verify that I'm one of the good ones?
That is the innovation. They replaced the gross receipts model with a behavioral model. They call it the 9 questions.
It sounds like a secret initiation. Answer the 9 questions to pass.
Laughs. It's actually a really clever mechanism. Instead of digging through your tax returns to see how much money you made, they present you with 9 specific operational agreements.
And you have to agree to them to get the lower rates.
You have to contractually agree to these conditions to even qualify for the program.
Are these like super restrictive conditions? Are they asking you to wrap your clients in bubble wrap?
No. They are surprisingly practical but strict. The source material gives a few key examples. The biggest one involves elevated stands.
Tree stands. The number one cause of hunting accidents, statistically.
Right. Gravity is the biggest enemy in the woods. Falling out of tree is way more common than getting shot.
So what's a condition?
It's simple. If you are a guide and you use tree stands, you must require your guests to wear a safety harness. No exceptions.
That just seems like common sense.
It is, but in the old days, it might have been a suggestion. Or maybe the guide provides it but doesn't force the client to put it on because they don't want to be rude.
Right, you don't want to be awkward.
And now it's a contractual obligation. If a client falls and wasn't wearing a harness and you attested that you would require it, you could have a major coverage issue.
Mm-hmm.
It forces the guide to be the enforcer.
What about vehicles? I saw a mention of ATVs.
That's another big one. ATVs and UTVs. The rule is simple. If the wheels are moving, the helmets are on.
I know a lot of hunters who are going to roll their eyes at that. You're driving 5 miles an hour to a blind across a flat field.
Do you really need a helmet? The AHLA says yes. And more importantly, the data says yes. Head injuries on ATVs are a massive claim driver. So the trade-off is explicit. We will give you this significantly lower insurance rate, but you have to wear the helmet.
It's a direct financial incentive. They are monetizing safety. Wear the helmet, save $1,000.
That is the perfect way to put it. They were shifting the model from you pay more because you make more to you pay less because you behave better.
I love that. It puts the control back in the hands of the operator. If I'm willing to enforce the rules, I save money.
And the HLA is transparent about it. They claim these restrictions aren't overly restrictive, and I'd agree. These are things you should probably be doing anyway. But by codifying them, they unlock the savings.
Okay, so let's look at the user experience. Because even if the price is right, buying commercial insurance is usually a nightmare. I'm envisioning like fax machines and triplicate forms.
You aren't far off. The source describes the old way vividly. You download a PDF, it's 7 pages long. You print it out, you fill it out by hand.
Hope your handwriting is legible.
Right. You mail it or scan it to an agency, and then you wait.
The waiting game, which is stressful if your season starts next week.
You wait days, sometimes weeks, just to get a quote. Then you negotiate. Then you pay. It's slow, it's analog, and it's opaque. You have no idea what you're paying until the very end.
And in the gig economy, where everything is instant, that just feels archaic. I can book a flight to Tokyo in 30 seconds on my phone. Why does it take 3 weeks to insure my business?
It's a friction point that drives people crazy. So the AHLA decided to modernize the infrastructure. They built a digital platform. They want the experience to feel like buying something on Amazon, not, applying for a mortgage.
So no 7-page PDFs.
Gone. You go to the website, you answer the questions, you get a quote instantly for free. And if you like the number, you can buy it right then and there.
Right.
The claim is less than 10 minutes.
From weeks of waiting to 10 minutes, that is a massive efficiency jump.
And the coverage starts the very next day.
That's huge. I can imagine a scenario where a guide realizes on a Friday night, oh no, my policy expired, and they have a client arriving Saturday morning.
In the old system, they'd be screwed. They'd be guiding uninsured, which is a disaster waiting to happen.
Now they can just hop online.
Hop online, pay the premium, and by sunrise, they are legal. It removes the excuse for being uninsured.
There is a quirk in the timing, though, right? I noticed the source mentions fixed dates.
Yes, and this is important for the listener to understand. This is a master policy. Think of it like a giant umbrella that the AHLA holds. When you buy insurance from them, you are effectively stepping under that existing umbrella.
You aren't writing a custom policy from scratch.
Exactly. You're joining a group. It's collective bargaining power. And to keep the administration costs down, which keeps the premiums down, they operate on fixed yearly cycles. The dates are July 1st or January 1st.
Why those dates? Is that arbitrary?
No, it's strategic. They align with the seasons. If you buy in July, you're covered for the entire fall and winter hunting season. If you buy in January, you're covered for the spring turkey season and the summer fishing season.
It prevents the administrative nightmare of having thousands of policies all expiring on different days of the year.
Correct. It's a set it and forget it model for the operational year. You buy it and you know you're good for the full season.
Okay, so we've got a better pricing model based on behavior and a better delivery system based on technology. This is clearly a win for the guides, but I want to zoom out to the listener who might not be a guide. Why should the average hunter care about how their outfitter buys insurance?
This is the so what of the episode, right?
Yeah.
And it connects directly to the economics of the sport. Sean Fabrock makes a really strong point about this. He says, let's be honest, any time a business has to pay exorbitant fees for insurance, that cost will be passed on to the customer.
Basic economics. If the guide's overhead goes up, my day rate goes up.
Exactly. If a guide has to pay $5,000 a year for insurance instead of, say, $1,500, that $3,500 difference has to come from somewhere. It comes from higher ticket prices for the hunts.
And when prices go up,
Fewer people can afford to go.
it creates a barrier to entry. We're circling right back to the original mission from 2010, saving the sport. If it becomes a rich man's game, the numbers drop and the political support for hunting just evaporates.
It's all connected. If you price the average American out of hunting, the tradition dies. Fabrick calls this program a win-win-win.
Let's break down the wins.
Okay, win number one, the guide. They get significantly reduced operating costs. That helps them stay profitable. And quite literally keeps food on their table.
It lets the little guy compete.
Right. Win number two, the hunter. Lower overhead for the guide means more stable pricing for you, the client. It keeps the trips affordable.
And win number three,
the sport itself. By keeping the ecosystem healthy, by keeping guides in business and hunters in the field, you preserve the culture. It sounds dramatic to say that insurance preserves culture, but in a litigious society like ours, it absolutely does.
It's the invisible infrastructure. If the infrastructure crumbles, the whole thing falls down.
And there's one more layer to this that I think is crucial, maybe the most important win of all.
Which is?
Safety. By tying the insurance coverage directly to those safety behaviors, the harnesses, the helmets, the HLA isn't just saving money. They are theoretically making the woods safer.
That's a great point. If I'm a guide and I know my cheap insurance requires safety harnesses, I am going to be militant about my clients wearing them.
It removes the nice guy negotiation.
Mm-hmm.
The guide can just say, look, I can't let you up that tree without a harness because my insurance will drop me. It gives the guide the authority to enforce safety without feeling awkward about it.
So we are seeing a shift where insurance goes from being a passive tax on revenue to an active incentive for safety.
That is the core takeaway. It challenges the lazy assumption that big business equals big risk. It says, no, behavior equals risk. And if you are willing to behave responsibly, you shouldn't have to subsidize the guys who don't.
I really like that framing. It rewards professionalism. It tells the operator your competence has value.
And it uses technology to deliver that value instantly. The shift from paper forms to digital quoting is just the cherry on top. It respects the user's time.
It's amazing to think this all started with land leases. They saw the model work for dirt insuring the land itself, and now they are applying it to the human element.
It's a logical evolution. You secure the land, then you secure the people working on the land.
So looking forward, do you see this model expanding? Could this go beyond hunting?
I think it has to. If this pilot works, and given the success of their land program, there's no reason to think it won't, it sets a precedent. Think about other outdoor industries, fishing charters, climbing guides.
Hiking tours, even. Why are they paying premiums based on generic risk pools?
Exactly. Why should a climbing guide who only does beginner roads on bolted faces pay the same rate as someone doing alpine ascents on loose rock? If you can quantify the behavior, you can unbundle the risk.
It empowers the niche. It allows the industry to self-regulate a bit.
And for the hunter or the client, it gives you something to look for. Next time you book a guide, pay attention. If they are strict about the safety harness, if they insist on the helmet, don't be annoyed.
Don't roll your eyes.
Don't roll your eyes. Realize that strictness might be the sign of a smart business person who is part of a program like this. It might be the reason you could afford the trip in the first place.
That is a very distinct possibility. The helmet isn't just protecting your head, it's protecting your wallet.
Laughs. I like that. I might steal that line.
So, to recap what we've covered today, the AHLA identified a massive inefficiency in how outdoor guides were being insured. The old model punished success by taxing gross receipts.
Essentially treating a profitable business as a dangerous one, which makes zero sense.
And the new model rewards safety. It uses the 9 questions to vet behavior. If you agree to the safety protocols, you get the lower rate.
And they wrapped it all in a modern digital package that takes 10 minutes instead of 10 days.
And ultimately, this isn't just about profit margins for a few outfitters. It's about keeping the barrier to entry low enough that the tradition of hunting can survive for another generation.
It's an economic solution to a cultural problem. And usually those are the solutions that actually stick.
It really makes you think about the hidden economics of your hobbies. We see the gear, we see the travel, we see the photos on Instagram. We rarely see the paperwork that makes it all legal and viable.
And usually when we do see the paperwork, it's because it's a problem. In this case, the paperwork is the solution.
Well, there you have it. A deep dive into the world of liability insurance that I hope proved it's more than just fine print. It raises an interesting final thought for me. We often talk about voting with our dollars, but in this case, the insurance industry is asking guides to vote with their habits. It makes me wonder what other industries could benefit from this switch moving from taxing income to rewarding behavior.
It is a powerful concept. If you can measure the behavior, you can price the risk accurately, and that benefits everyone.
Something to mull over next time you're signing a waiver before a big adventure.
Thanks for listening to another deep dive. We'll catch you on the next one.